Barbara Kingsolver. Flight Behavior. 2012. Some of the finest American novels were written at least partly in the hope of effecting moral change. From Huckleberry Finn and Uncle Tom's Cabin, through The Grapes of Wrath and beyond, runs a clear and brilliant arc of explicit concern with poverty and social injustice. Barbara Kingsolver's Flight Behavior is a worthy new member of that company, its concerns embodied in the vivid characters of a novel written with passion and intelligence. What is new is that her scathingly accurate depictions of societal imbalance are closely interwoven with urgent concern about environmental imbalance, the ongoing catastrophe that no serious writer will be allowed to ignore much longer. Many reviewers, predictably dismissing Kingsolver as earnest but naive, or scolding her for not knowing where monarch butterflies winter, evidently don't know how to read a writer so gifted at seeing and portraying both sides of a social dilemma, and so adept at invention based firmly on knowledge. This scientifically trained novelist uses imagination to illuminate reality, and irony to transcend irony. The conventionally baroque and grotesque Southern novel in her hands gains the breadth and aplomb of South American magic realism. Describing flight behavior for British readers is a problem, particularly in its humor. It's very American, regional, dialectical, an equivalent of those very British novels that Americans read while wishing they could catch the implications and nuances and knowing they don't. To the ear that recognizes them, the cadences are perfect. When the heroine's friend says, "Here's the thing. You looked buku hot. Can I borrow that sweater?" Or when her mother-in-law says, "Lord Almighty, the girl is receiving grace," will the complex indications and references of the language carry across the Atlantic? I can only hope so, because the implications are fiercely revealing, and the nuances often very funny. I had the opportunity to ask the author if there was an aspect of the book she felt critics had missed so far. She pondered briefly and said, "Class. Another problem for me, American class definition is so much vaguer and less conscious than in England. All the same, poor is poor." And Kingsolver is right. Reviewers have talked about the butterflies, not the characters, ignoring the stunning complexity of the novel's achievement in showing how social factors, class, education, privilege, religion, control individual interaction with the processes we call nature, the world we live in. These days, many Americans proclaim that they do not believe in global warming or evolution or science. What has led to such foolish, perilous denial? To lay it to ignorance, stupidity, republicanism, or Southern redneckism is to evade the question in a particularly arrogant and cowardly way. Kingsolver tackles it head-on because she knows and respects the people she writes about, the vivid, vulnerable, beleaguered, unconsidered hicks who have no credit in any sense of the word and who get little help and a great deal of disinformation when they try to understand the world and their place in it. The heroine and viewpoint character of the story has lived her 20-some years in the worldwide entrapment of bottom feeders, as she calls it, not hungry but living on boxed mac and cheese, pinching every dollar yet never out of debt, second-hand car, second-hand clothes. Her mother named her Delarobia in the hopeful notion that the name was biblical. It turned out to mean a wreath of acorns and such glued on to cardboard. When she finds it may refer to an Italian artist, Delarobia feels better about it, but generally speaking, she doesn't feel very good about herself. She doesn't feel deserving or entitled. She feels inadequate and unworthy. She wants to go to college, but got pregnant and had to marry Cub, who pretty much lives up to his name. She miscarried that baby, but had two more, now 6 and 2 years old. Overwhelmed, seeing no way out, she has decided to run off with the handsome telephone man. In the first chapter of the book, she's on her way to meet him through a dark fir forest when the hillsides of trees around her catch fire, blazing up in orange flames, burning, unconsumed. And she receives grace. "Jesus," she said, not calling for help. She and Jesus weren't that close, but putting her voice in the world because nothing else made sense. The sparks spiraled upward in swirls like funnel clouds. Unearthly beauty had appeared to her, a vision of beauty to stop her in the road. For her alone, these orange boughs lifted. These long shadows became a brightness rising. Films of monarch butterfly gathering places in Mexico or California show us a shadow of that brightness. The scene of the miracle soon becomes exactly that, a place of pilgrimage, particularly after the nearest TV station sends elegantly coiffed and booted Tina out to interview bewildered Delarobia. Posed for the photographer among the swirling clouds of thousands of butterflies, she confesses that she'd been about to throw her life away when she saw that here was something so much bigger. I had to come back and live a different life. The photograph goes viral on the internet, the Madonna of the Butterflies, and her father-in-law, who can't understand who the hell has the right to stop him from logging his fir trees to help cover his debts, finds himself the villain of a lurid environmental drama. TV Tina returns to interview Dr. Byron, the lepidopterist, who has come to study this unprecedented and, in fact, highly ominous phenomenon of monarchs wintering so far from their ancestral migratory roots. Delarobia is understandably smitten with the scientist, the first man who ever noticed she had a mind. He respects her, teaches her, gives her a job, and is kind to her kids. But under the relentless obtuseness of Tina's questions, he loses his careful detachment. It's a fine confrontation. Tina blinking and asking, "Are we talking about global warming here?" And cutting the camera off as soon as the scientist says, "Yes, we are." Her repeated glib rephrasings that trivialize whatever he says, his increasingly fierce refusals to evade or concede. It's what we never see on TV because, if it happens, it isn't aired. Tina and the cameraman storm out to destroy the film. The scientist tears his hair in shame at blowing his one great chance to present his side of the story. And Delarobia's friend, Dovey, holds up her smartphone. "Yo, guys," she says, "don't worry. I got it all. Posting it now. YouTube." It's a fine moment of simple dramatic satisfaction. The book is full of such unpretentious pleasures, but the deep and lasting satisfaction of it is in the quiet, implacable unfolding of its great theme. Our need, our desperate need as human beings, to begin to live a different life.